From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made this past April on the campus of Harvard. That's when the first of a string of announcements came out. Harvard will be building a multi-million dollar science and engineering complex. Harvard will be building a multi-million dollar rugby complex. Harvard will have a new facility for women's field hockey. Well, the good news is that somewhere, billionaires are deciding that their philanthropic dollars can go to the truly needy at Harvard. And just look at what Harvard is able to do with that cash. Of course, Harvard's sticker price has not come down. It's roughly $65,000 annually to attend, if you get in. Harvard claims to offer outreach to economically disadvantaged students, but many of the best students in this country who come from true poverty never even apply to the top schools. Now, we're picking on Harvard, but let's go beyond the Ivy League. In the past month, we've talked quite a bit about the cost of higher education on this show. University of Rochester graduate Kevin Connell is the author of a new book just released called Breaking Point: The College Affordability Crisis and Our Next Financial Bubble. Tomorrow, he's back in town to give a book talk at College Town's Barnes & Noble. But first, he's right here on Connections. Nice to see you back here, Kevin.
Thanks for having me.
Last time we had talked to Kevin, he actually turned his research and initial book project into two. And so we talked about for-profit universities last time with a book called what? The last effort was what?
Degrees of Deception.
Degrees of Deception. So now we're moving on to not for-profit. We're talking about just sort of higher ed in general and the cost of college. And I know you've had a chance to hear some of what we've discussed on this program in recent weeks. It was just 3 weeks ago that the president of Nazareth College, Don Braveman, was here. And he wanted to push back a little on this popular perception from the government to the news media on down that the cost of college has exploded. Because as Don Braveman says, if you look at the College Board, yes, the sticker price has exploded, but the actual cost that students pay has not. And if we could, let's listen to what Don Braveman did say about that.
What the net cost is, it's actually gone up 30% in 26 years, which comes out to 1.17% a year. So there's somewhat of a misperception about an exploding cost of higher education.
He's talking about private schools and did acknowledge that the cost of higher education for public schools has gone up more sharply. And the New York Times and others have said that could be because state aid cuts are down for public schools. But Kevin, let me just start right there and ask you what you make of that comment.
I would say there is no misperception. I would say that, let's just look at the facts.
Okay.
I went back each decade back to 1966, 76, 86, so on. So over the last 50 years, I examined the increase in price. To attend a private four-year institution, it has increased by 1,600%. To a public out-of-state student, 2,000%, and to a public in-state student, 2,700%. Now, those are all the sticker prices.
Sticker prices.
I understand that. At the same time, we have to think about this like a sliding scale, because the student back in 1966, when the cost of attending a public four-year in-state institution was $360, that student still wasn't paying the full $360 sticker price. So I understand that everybody's not paying $60,000 a year, but wherever they were on that sliding spectrum has also gone up by 1,600% or 2,000% or 2,700% since 1966. And the explanation in terms of in order to substantiate that is in the debt burdens. You know, if this was some sort of marginal increase, we wouldn't have a $1.45 trillion national student loan debt. And even if you want to break that down on in terms of household debt, in 2011, average household student debt was $23,000. In 2015, that had risen to $35,000. So we see the exponential curve in terms of the progress that college costs are surging.
Okay. Now, one of the reasons that we heard from our guests on the last time we talked about this, both the president of Nazareth College and Ian Mortimer with their administration, you know, I don't think they claim to have a perfect answer for this, but we did say, look, how come loan debt is so high then? And one of the reasons is income inequality is sharper now than it's been than at any point since before World War II. In other words, people are getting out, they're getting degrees, but they're not making as much money, you know, per capita by income, and therefore they're carrying more loan debt, they're not paying it off as much. And we've seen, especially since 2007, 2008, 2009, that exacerbated. Do you buy that?
Well, and Mike, I forgot. I missed. Who said that?
Don Braveman, president of Nazareth College and one of the members of the administration there.
Well, I would just be, I'm very interested then why colleges, you know, Nazareth included, why colleges, if that is a concern in terms of unemployment and underemployment, why colleges continue to offer programs that aren't getting people well-paying jobs. And the real reason for that is that colleges don't have skin in the game on post-graduation performance of students. It is all on what colleges are spending, what resources they offer. That is the criteria by which colleges are ranked by U.S. News and World Report. So if this was really a concern of theirs, and they actually identify that as the big issue, then why are they perpetuating that issue?
Okay. Well, and I think that they would tell you, and probably justifiably so, that it is still much more valuable to have a college degree than not. And I'm not saying, I'm saying two categories, have a college degree or don't, not what did it cost to get the college degree,
right,
but just in terms of your income expectation, no doubt having a college degree still puts it much higher, right?
Correct.
Okay. So let's back up then and ask you, before we kind of continue down this road, how this book even came together in the first place. You were at the University of Rochester. What happened?
So I was offered very early on in my freshman year an opportunity to conduct an independent study with the president emeritus of the university, Tom Jackson. The idea did not come until the following summer when my financial aid package had been significantly reduced. And in addition to the 4% tuition increase, my mom, who has two master's degrees, she's now a superintendent, at the time was a principal, she said to me, you know, Kevin, I don't know if I'm going to be able to afford to send you to the University of Rochester if it continues to increase like this each year. And I just thought to myself, she is very successful. She makes a good living. She's struggling to send one kid to college. What is a blue-collar family doing with several children? And so at that point, I did some digging, and the rest is history.
And I see the phone starting to ring. Listeners, if you want to weigh in with any questions for author Kevin Connell about his book, his research into the cost of higher ed, or your comments on the matter, you can call toll-free 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. Kevin is going to be at the College Town Barnes & Noble tomorrow, 11:30 in the morning, and that is a free event. He's going to be talking about the book, and the books will be there. We know this because they just got there.
Yes, so, they did.
All right, so 11:30 tomorrow morning at the College Town Barnes & Noble. You want to hear more from him about this. Before I jump in with phone calls, because as I said, we're already hearing from listeners on this, then what happened was, as I understand it, is this research project eventually became a book idea, but how did you get there?
Well, I wrote and I researched for 3 years, and we had thought about potentially making it a thesis, a senior thesis. But at that time, we analyzed the length of the work, the quality of the work, the timeliness of the topic, and both of us came to the conclusion that we ought to go for a book. And honestly, one of the big reasons for this is I tried to write this manuscript in a way that people who are struggling with this issue can read it and understand it, and so they know what's going on. I didn't want to write this for a handful of academics for it to sit dusty on a shelf. I want people who are struggling with this on a daily basis to be able to understand what is going on and why they are struggling.
Or parents who are thinking about, or families who are thinking about, students who are thinking about higher ed, right?
Absolutely.
All right, let me grab our first phone call. It's Tom in Pittsford. Go ahead, Tom.
When I went to school in the 50s, now that's a long time ago, but I paid for school. It was about $800 a year, including board and room and everything else, at a private school. So you could work in the summer and pay for it. Work in the summer and do, I worked around tables, served in dining hall in the winter, and that's all. And I never borrowed any money. Nobody, I didn't know anybody that borrowed any money for school. You had enough money working in the summer. So that's how things have changed, and that's sort of a broad scope. But that's what I think about the schools in general and the cost.
In other words, but Tom, and I think we lost time, but I think he's saying paid for it by working in the summer. Can students realistically expect now to pay for school by working during the summer?
No, they can't. It's interesting. I actually got into a Facebook exchange with the current dean of admissions at the University of Rochester over the summer. And when I expressed to him that I had a $93,000 debt from the U of R, he said to me, well, Kevin, we would never advise anyone to take out $93,000 in loans. We would always encourage them to pay for it in current income and assets. Well, that's just a ridiculous statement. Who has $100,000 sitting around in the bank? Who's going to sell their home and live under a bridge so they can pay for their student debt? And to me, what the last caller just, what he just illustrated was how we have gone from a system that provided a reasonably affordable education to one that is not affordable, not sustainable. And I think that it highlights how out of touch college administrators in particular are from the reality that many people face.
Okay. To the phones we go again, and Linda in Penfield next up. Go ahead, Linda.
Hi. I'd like to make a comment to the speaker when he mentioned that he was talking about wages and why colleges still continue to have majors that may not pay the best wages. And I really take exception to that because, yes, we are talking about college increases of crazy percent, and that wages for all Americans have stagnated. And we have to ask ourselves, so why can't we pay our people more? And I know the reason why. It is because the people in the 1% have made more money than the people like you and I, where our wages have stagnated. And I have said to anybody who has listened to me that if those folks would lop off 10 off of their wages, how many people could they employ and how many wages could go up? I'm sorry, I just get really ticked about that. And I think talk shows should have CEOs on to really explain this.
Linda, thank you for the phone call. I will say, and I will endorse the idea of us having more CEOs on. And I'm looking right at producer Megan Mack. And you know what, Linda? We'll put out that call, sort of renew our efforts with that. I think those are interesting conversations to have. Is she making a fair point, Kevin Cohen?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and you know, as a Democrat, as a Bernie supporter, I totally agree that concentration of wealth in this country is terrible. What I will say, though, is that it's not only about what jobs are paying. It's about what jobs are people getting when they get out. And so we have many people who are leaving college with college debt, and they're leaving with degrees that are not marketable in the workforce. So they are severely either unemployed or underemployed, and those jobs aren't going to pay. I mean, even if it's a living wage of $15, say we get the $15 minimum wage, if you have a huge student loan debt and you're very well educated, the academic merit is there, but the practical merit isn't. And it's unsustainable. You know, right now, again, $1.4 trillion national student loan debt. To put that into perspective, if you take the GDP of Spain, South Korea, Mexico, Australia, take your pick, their GDP is roughly $1.3 trillion annually. So our national student loan debt is greater than the entire economies of any one of those countries. And mind you, those are the top 15 wealthiest countries in the world. So, you know, and the recipe for disaster is we load up people with lots of debt with degrees that aren't going to get them decent paying jobs. And I'm not saying that we should be getting rid of programs that don't make you a multimillionaire. I'm not saying that. I'm simply saying that if a degree sets you up for financial disaster, that you're not a contributing member of society afterwards, a self-sustaining member of society afterwards, we need to take a serious look at that.
Okay. And as I get ready to go back to your phone calls, because you've touched a nerve already, Kevin, I'm kind of torn between two ideas, which is that, you know, Don Braveman, who was kind enough to give his time on two separate occasions for this program, is pointing to the numbers that the New York Times itself has highlighted. David Lenhart in the New York Times 2 summers ago, how the government exaggerates the cost of college, essentially making the same points, looking at the College Board, looking at sticker price versus actual. And I think if David Lenhart was here, he would say to Kevin Connell, you're right that 30 years ago, it wasn't just everyone was paying the full sticker. There was aid, there were scholarships, there was cost forgiveness then. But he would probably say it wasn't at the rate it is today. That today, very few students pay the full price. I remember asking Don Braveman, how many students at Nazareth out of 2,000 are paying the full price, 41,000 plus? And the answer was a small handful, almost none. You know, and so I doubt that was the case 30 years ago, Kevin. And I feel like David Lenhart would make the point to you, you know, that's a little bit apples to oranges. And yet you're pointing to $1.4 trillion in loan debt, and that's real. That's there. So if there were only a gradual cost increase that is no different really than it's been for years, then what are we sitting here with a mountain of loan debt for? So I'm kind of pushed and pulled in both directions. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And, you know, just to highlight in terms of the number of students that would be paying full time or full amount, back in 1940, national enrollment was 1.4 million students. Today it's over 20 million. So I think just by nature, as time has gone on, the widespread access to loans, which is different than widespread affordability, it's a temporary blank check, but the ability to access loans as a result of the National Defense Education Act in 1958 and the Higher Education Act in 1965, that has increased the sheer volume of students from all areas of background. So I would say that in previous decades, fewer and fewer students who would need that sort of assistance were attending college. Only the wealthy were attending college, which is precisely the reason why we enacted that legislation in the late 50s, mid and early 60s.
All right. I know some may be wondering, well, what does Kevin Connell say that we do about this? We're going to get the author's take on that. I want to make sure we stay in rhythm with your phone calls because we're getting a lot. So next up, let's go to Stone in South Bristol. Go ahead, Stone.
Hi, thank you. And thank you, Mr. Connell, for these wonderful and badly needed efforts. I was a grad student at the U of R long ago, more than 30 years ago, and I must say I find the dean's response to you just scurrilous. Basically what he's saying is you can't afford to go here, and here you have a mother who's a highly accomplished professional. Anyways, I'll be quick. I went to Berkeley in the late 70s. In-state tuition was $233 a term, yep. Hence $700 a year. I was out of state, add another $600 a term, hence $2,500 a year to go to the premier public university on the planet.
And what year was that, Stone?
78, 9.
All right, Megan Mack, let's do a little inflation calculator. In 1978, $2,500 translates to what today? All right, go ahead, Stone.
I'll get out off the phone here and let other people through, but I mentioned this last spring to a boy going to Nazareth who was complaining about his debt, and I said, well, this was my experience. And he said, God, man, why would you tell me that? Thank you. Bye.
Thank you, Stone. Go ahead.
Well, those numbers are right on because my sheet right here, public four-year out-of-state tuition in 1976, the average was $2,067. So you are right on the money.
And $2,500 at Berkeley, so right in that range.
Yep.
He also brought up that letter that you got. Were you insulted by that, by the way?
You know, it's... I mean, I don't want to be critiquing somebody who's not here to defend himself. I guess my point is that I think that is just reflective of the general out of touch kind of mentality that many administrators have. You know, that is not personally against him. It's not against the University of Rochester. It is just universally, so many college administrators are out of touch. They're either totally clueless or they know what's going on and they're misrepresenting those figures to students. And I don't know which one frightens me more.
All right. We're giving producer Megan Mack math questions, which is the last thing she wants. There's one more I just sent you. Take a look there. So we'll circle back to that there. Before I get back to the phones, one more additional question on that. University of Rochester, you went to school there. Did you get a good education there?
Absolutely. And this is, I was actually talking to Paul Burgett,
yeah,
at the University of Rochester. And one of the things that I said to him is, I said, look, I know, we both know I'm critical of financing in higher education, but I had an incredible experience at the University of Rochester. It was everything that I could have hoped for. The academic experience was amazing. The financial, not so much, but...
Do you drive him nuts, by the way? I mean, you know, because you're praising the U of R, but you're talking about higher ed, and they're, you know, their sticker's over 60.
Correct. You know, it's, well, and Rochester's is in the top 3% of regions of student debt burden. So this isn't exclusively to the University of Rochester either. It's everywhere. And I guess, you know, I I don't mention the U of R at all in my book, except in the intro section that I'm a recent college grad. And the reason for that is because it's unfair to cherry pick against them. They are part of a system, and the system is grossly unfair, it's misguided, and it's unsustainable.
Back to the phones. Betsy in Brighton next up. Go ahead, Betsy.
Yeah, we have two daughters in college right now. One's in graduate school and the other one's a senior at Wellesley. And the first year, Wellesley gave her, you know, a couple, like $20,000 for not merit, just aid. But when her sister went into graduate school, even though we were still paying college tuition, they didn't give us anything. And we had to really fight every single year, right up to this year, to get any money from them. And we never found out until the day before the bill was due what they were finally going to help us out with. And tuition there is $60,000 a year, or the total bill that we're paying is $60,000 a year. The other comment I want to make is kids in graduate school, my daughter's in medical school, and some of her classmates are hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt, and it affects what specialty they go into because they feel like they can't afford to go into primary care specialties because they have so much debt that they have to pay back. And when they're in residency programs, they're barely getting paid subsistence wages, like $30,000 a year. Mm-hmm. And if they have families, they can't keep a roof over their head with that, as well as paying back their debt. So these issues compound people further into their lives. It's not just when can they buy a house. It's whether they go into an altruistic occupation or something that's going to pay them back.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the phone call, Betsy. Kevin Connell, go ahead.
Well, as a fellow graduate student who's going to be in about $250,000 after law school, I totally understand. One point that I also want to highlight in terms of financial aid, and this varies on an institutional basis, but some colleges and universities, including the University of Rochester, they don't provide a fixed financial aid package, meaning that every year you have to reapply for your financial aid. And what tends to happen is the student has less leverage as time goes on because you've made more of an investment each year. And what they end up doing is they reduce your financial aid package in addition to tuition going up.
All right, now hold on a second here. If they do that, I mean, this is a situation where they seem to be, and I don't want to assume here, but you can help me with this, right? If you've been going for 2 years and you reapply for the aid package and all of a sudden now your aid is reduced, which you experienced?
Absolutely.
Which Betsy is talking about?
Yes.
They're almost daring you to walk away because you're almost pot committed. So you're going to find a way to come up with that money one way or another because you're halfway through your education, right?
Yes.
That seems very uncomfortable.
And, you know, few students do it. I know,
Few students walk away?
Few students walk away, you know, and there. I know several people at the University of Rochester who were forced to walk away. Alex Wark, who has done tremendous work while he was there in terms of fighting the financial aid system, I believe he went to Binghamton after a couple of years at the U of R for that very reason. And I think it's heartbreaking. It's totally wrong. And it's disgusting to me in a way, because then everyone pats themselves on the back on commencement day. You know, everyone talks about colleges as these pure institutions. But at the end of the day, underneath that academic regalia, they're still wearing the same $2,000 suit. It's nothing more than another type of business. They are there to function as a business. They're providing a service. They're providing a good. This is not about educating students for the sake of educating them.
All right, so I'm just going to play devil's advocate here because I've been referring to President Braveman from Nazareth College, and I can't get inside someone's head. Unlike past presidents, I can't look into someone's soul, but I think Don Braveman, as best I can tell, is very much committed to the idea of building a more knowledgeable society. He views higher ed in that role. I think he views it very seriously. And you're sort of, your statement is pretty broad, but it's pretty damning about higher ed here, Kevin. And I wonder if it's not charitable enough to at least their motives.
Well, in terms of motives, if your motive is to create a more well-functioning society, if you really care about your students, you're going to ensure that you are making students successful once they leave. You're not going to load them up with huge debt burdens. You're not going to offer programs that statistically lead them into unemployment and underemployment. So I just find it really disingenuous that these people actually care about their students when they know that they are doing things that are going to cripple them for decades financially. We have stripped an entire generation of purchasing power. And when we, again, when we put 18 to 24-year-olds primarily into $1.4 trillion national student loan debt, they can't buy a house, they can't buy a car, they can't start a family, they can't save for retirement. Their lives are ruined before they even start. So, I mean, I understand what you're saying, and I'm sure that there are many people out there that who do have good motives. But at the end of the day, they're not. Those motives are misguided. They're uninformed. Too many students are leaving college and they're poorly impacted from it.
Okay, let's get our only break of the hour, and we'll come back to your phone calls. If you're waiting on the phone to talk to author Kevin Connell, we're coming to you shortly. He is the author of a brand new book called Breaking Point, The College Affordability Crisis and Our Next Financial Bubble. Kevin's back in Rochester. He's a U of R graduate. Back from where? Where are you now, by the way?
I am down at William & Mary in Colonial Williamsburg, Virginia.
Racking up more loan debt?
More loan debt. It's about $180,000 after my 3 years there. So.
Okay. He's going to be tomorrow morning, 11:30. He'll be at College Town's Barnes & Noble. That's on Mount Hope. And that event, what are you going to be doing there? Reading? Just talking about the book? Talking about the issues?
It'll just be a short talk, a Q&A. I would love, you know, particularly I'm trying to host it at the College Town because I'm trying to get U of R students. But, you know, this is open to the public. Anybody who is either concerned or interested with this topic, by all means, come out, because the more people that come, not only does it demonstrate the currentness and the importance of the issue, but always hearing from different perspectives, hearing different people's stories, it always helps me. And I think the collective group benefits as well.
All right. So that's tomorrow morning at 11:30 at College Town Barnes & Noble. Let's get that break and come right back to your phone calls next. Coming up in our second hour, Read Local. You've heard of Eat Local or Drink Local. What about Read Local? Well, that's a series created by Writers and Books and Open Letter Books, and they have brought in Josephine Klugart. They call her the Virginia Woolf of Denmark. Her newest book is One of Us is Sleeping. She's in Rochester. We'll talk to her about her book and about this movement called Read Local and what it all means. That's next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and let's go back to your phone calls. David in Pittsford, next up. Go ahead, David.
Yes, I have a couple of comments here. For one thing, this statistic on the percentage of students who get student aid. My son went to Cornell, and he was awarded $25 a year in student aid.
$25,000?
No, $25.
What? $25?
Yes. And so he was one of that large percentage of the students who get student aid. So I think you need to take a hard look at that statistic to see if they're playing games with it.
I see. So, David, you're saying when they say they're offering aid to a lot of students, $25 counts as aid.
That's correct.
Okay. I appreciate the phone call. I can't speak to that with any knowledge on whether that is anecdotally an outlier or not. I don't know. Kevin Connell, do you know?
I mean, I don't know if it's quite to that degree in terms of a general statement. I have no doubt that situation exists. I think that. You know, many students receive small amounts of aid, not quite to the degree of $25 that is counted by it. But I absolutely agree with your point that those figures might be misrepresented in terms of how well we are actually helping students.
Okay. Connie writes to the program via email. Evan, my sister's daughter went to Boston University, and her aid package dropped dramatically after freshman year and then again after sophomore year. Mm-hmm. She transferred as a junior to a New Jersey state school, Rutgers, and had a wonderful experience in the end. Knowing this often happens, it seems to make more sense to spend the first 2 years at a cheaper school, then transfer to the, quote, top university and graduate with a degree from the prestigious institution. In other words, choose a community college or state school for freshman and sophomore years, from Connie. Right now, in the current landscape, does that make sense to you, Kevin?
Absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting. Being local from the area, I grew up going to Rush Henrietta, and MCC was often referred to as the 13th grade in the high school. And what I can say is, having researched this topic, having become familiar with MCC, they are fantastic Vice President Biden came here, you know, to say that MCC is a leader in this. So I absolutely encourage students, particularly students who don't know what you want to do. If you don't know what you want to do, why would you go pay top dollar to find yourself for the first few years? Get those prerequisites out of the way. Go to a community college for cheap and then try to transfer in. Now, the drawback is there's no guarantee then in terms of being able to transfer in. So you have to do kind of a cost-benefit analysis there. But if you feel confident that you'd be able to transfer and you don't quite know what you want to do, I absolutely recommend going to a cheaper college to begin with.
Okay. Chris in Rochester next up, who is, I think Chris said he's offended by Kevin's attitude. Is that right, Chris?
Well, that might be a little too strong, especially with his comment just now about MCC, which I think is, you know, much more on point. So I've been listening for maybe the last 15 minutes, and I've really been struck by kind of the elitist attitude of the discussion. It's really all been about, well, you've got to go to Cornell, you've got to go to Wesleyan, you've got to go to BU. And the simple truth is, and I'm not hearing you talk, and I'm sure your book has it, so you know, take this for what it's worth, about going to SUNY. You know, the simple fact of the matter is, I went to SUNY undergraduate. I went to SUNY for law school. I'm in the solid six figures here in Rochester with a great career and a very proud SUNY graduate. When the guest said that it was heartbreaking that his friend had to leave the U of R to go to Binghamton, I mean, come on, wake up. His friend, it's not heartbreaking. His friend made the logical decision because guess what? Like me, his friend is going to graduate with, well, I graduated with no debt because I was able to work my way through. My son is currently going to SUNY, even though he had board scores at the 98th percentile and a 3.7, because he got offered admission into their honors program at SUNY Albany, my alma mater. And his all-in for last year, his freshman year, was $16,000. You know, think rationally, think economically intelligently, go to a SUNY school, knock it out of the park when you're there, and you know, then look at other options for grad school. But I'd like to challenge the author to take the focus off the, because when you're focused on the private schools, you're playing into the game. There's no way that if you're going to law school that you're going to be paying off your $250,000 debt anytime soon. Don't shackle yourself with that kind of debt. And the way to do that is by going to a SUNY school.
Thank you, Chris. Kevin Connell, go ahead.
No, I absolutely agree with you, actually. What I meant by heartbreaking was that students are forced to uproot themselves after a couple of years to go to an entirely different institution.
Okay, well, can you give a little ground? Is heartbreaking a little strong for a term there?
Well, incredibly disappointing.
Okay, there you go.
You know, as somebody who established roots at the University of Rochester, for me, I think it would be very difficult to leave after a couple of years. I mean, you're finally settled, and then you have to start back up again. In terms of public education, I'm a huge advocate of the SUNY system and other public alternatives. They're significantly cheaper, and in fact, I really liked your point about kind of private schools as outliers. They only constitute 8% of total college enrollment, while public colleges account for 80% national enrollment. So I absolutely agree that the focus needs to be on these public schools. And it's actually a point that I try to emphasize in the book, in terms of being realistic with the outcomes, in terms of the focus on where we need to be looking.
Sure. And to Chris's point, though, about the cost of school, there's no doubt public schools are less expensive, as you say, as Chris said, than most private schools. But the rate of increase annually for public schools is higher right now, significantly higher.
Correct.
Than the rate of increase for private schools, especially when you take off the sticker price. When you look at the actual price, after all the aid and cost forgiveness, public school rates are going up more quickly.
Correct. And, you know, this is due to a couple of things, I think. Number one is there have been significant reductions in state aid to state institutions.
Yep.
They're reducing funding. In fiscal year 2010, for example, there was an average of 13% decline in terms of cutting funds for public colleges. how am I going to phrase this? Public colleges, I mean, they are significantly cheaper in terms of tuition, but one way that they do kind of make up the difference is in room and board. Room and board accounts for, you know, it's still $13,000, $14,000 for room and board in a lot of these places. So even though the tuition might be a lot cheaper, even despite those reductions in aid, room and board and other fees are still right up there as expensive as private universities. So they are cheaper in some ways, but not cheaper in others.
Back to the phones we go. Every line lit up. So let me see here. Let me grab Wendy in Rochester next up. Go ahead, Wendy.
Hi. This is a fascinating subject. I read something at one point, and I wondered if your analysis in your book takes this into account or debunks it, which was that, like medicine, one of the reasons that the expenses in higher ed are going up faster than the rest of the economy is that there is no way to outsource it or make it robotic, or in other words, to decrease the expense of the people who are involved in it. There has been no gain in productivity in higher ed in the last 40 years, and so it kind of reflects a different economy than things like manufacturing. And I also wondered if there's any analysis that shows whether the SUNY schools are actually, factoring in where they get their different monies from, are they actually delivering the product for significantly less than they are at the private institutions? Because most of the private institutions are nonprofit, and so most of their money is supposed to be going back in some way, and I'm wondering if that's not what's happening, where's the money disappearing to, or do you think the money is disappearing somewhere? That's really all of it.
Okay, go ahead, Kevin.
Well, right now, colleges, I'm gonna read a quote from the Davis Educational Foundation, which they took a poll from 70 university and college presidents. And what they said was that colleges are driven 100% by prestige. And they said increasing amenities of both academic and recreational life as competition driven by a desire for prestige prevails as the predominant business model. One of the ways that they do this is to literally spend more. And one of the ways that they spend money is in a perpetual arms race.
An amenities war, right?
It's an arms race of amenities.
Yeah.
And what they do is they end up, if you look at the amount of spending on capital building projects and the amount of building projects that have gone on, over the last 30 years, the square footage of building projects has tripled. And then in addition to that, the cost per square foot has gone up by over 300% just in the last 20 years. So not only are we building more, but we're building more nice things. And the reason for that is, when do they hook? When do colleges hook prospective students? It's not on informative flyers on default rates. It's not on job placement data. It's when the naive 17 or 18-year-old goes on the college tour. And what do they do when you go on the college tour? They take you to the really nice dining hall. They take you to the rec center. They take you to the super dorm. And that process is not an informative process. It is a persuasive sales pitch, and they understand that. So what they're doing is they're dumping money up front into all of these things so that when prospective students go there, they say, oh my God, you know, I've got this shiny building and that shiny building, and look at how well I can eat at the dining hall, and wow, I have a co-ed sauna and a juice bar and a rock climb wall and a golf simulator like the $70 million renovation project at Kenyon College includes.
That's at Kenyon? I thought you were going to say Alabama, because Alabama has like a temple.
Exactly. It's everywhere. I mean, and you know, local colleges are actually pretty modest by these standards. I mean, Gergen Athletic Center at the University of Rochester is actually not all that elaborate compared to some of these other places where it's like an inside water park amusement park. It's crazy. So I think one of the ways is we're spending way too much on these amenities. Another is administrative bloat. We have seen, while colleges are actually making cuts to full-time faculty, the number of college administrators has doubled in terms of the pace of new professors. So we have widespread administrative bloat. We have this amenities war of offering more and more elaborate kind of country club atmosphere. And that's where the money's going. It's not into the things that actually make the education a higher quality.
Let me get back to your phone calls. And Rachel in Rochester talking about, when it comes to that prestige, she thinks high schools are focused too much on the prestige of the private over the public. Rachel?
Hi. Yeah, I wanted to make a few comments. First of all, I was really glad to hear what your guest had to say about MCC. I went there for my first 2 years, and I think it's a really undervalued resource in a lot of high schools and maybe in student communities. But I mean, there are so many great, valuable adjuncts there that teach.
Yes.
I think Glenn Johnson taught there for a little while. I took a law class from a lawyer that works in the area, and then I transferred on to Fredonia. And I just recall in high school, the state schools were never really talked up, and I had a great experience. I got my degree from Fredonia in history and went on to get my master's in history at the College of Charleston in South Carolina. So really, I'm under the amount of student debt that a lot of students have just after 1 year going to some of these private institutions that are great and really do have a lot of great resources. But I think it is important to kind of include these less expensive options in these discussions with students in high school, because I don't think I ever really got any of that, and I did get a really valuable education at these less expensive schools.
Thanks very much, Rachel, for the phone call. Kevin Connell.
Well, and I'm actually I'm slated to give a talk to my alma mater, Rush Henrietta, to students about this. I think that high school counseling offices are really stretched in terms of, I only had 15 or 20 minute discussion with my counselor just because of the sheer volume of students. And the time that they use on that is not kind of the big picture of what we're talking about now. It's assisting students through the nitty gritty details of getting through the Common App and filling out FAFSA paperwork, which is a daunting task for a 17 or 18 year old. So I absolutely agree that counselors need to give more emphasis on the big picture, particularly funneling those students to more affordable options, particularly to those students who don't know what they want to do. Now, if you know what you want to do, and that field is very, very competitive, there is an upper hand to going to an elite private university. It's just going to make you more competitive in terms of your resume. And I think it's an unfortunate reality, but a reality nonetheless. But without those exceptions, I absolutely agree with you 100%.
Okay. Abigail in Rochester next up with author Kevin Connell, who's the author of the new book, Breaking Point, The College Affordability Crisis and Our Next Financial Bubble. Go ahead, Abigail. Hi, Abigail. Are you there?
Thank you, first of all, for bringing this, talking about this in public. I am the parent of a junior, and I'm an educated parent, and I was educated, and I pushed hard with my son to really look at not just his first choice, but being applying to schools where he would be academically on the higher end of their spectrum so that they would offer him more money. And in fact, that's what ended up happening. He was offered significantly thousands more dollars from a private institution than the state institution with the same program. And that was his second choice, and he ended up going to his second choice. He'll end up graduating with like $15,000 worth of loan for a mechanical engineering program. He will be marketable. He's looking at graduate school. You know, and he may incur some debt in graduate school. So I think part of the responsibility, I do think that the schools are the colleges are packaging things like with bells and whistles, and it's unfair. But ultimately, I feel it is the parents' responsibility to really be sitting down with their children and saying, that may be what you want, but there is a big disparity between here and where we are at, and that will come out in loans.
not just what it will be in loans, but what will that mean for the length of your, you know, for 10 years you'll be paying $400. For 20 years you'll be paying this. Because children have no idea until you sit down with them and say, all right, you may come out as a mechanical engineer making $50,000 a year or $45,000 a year, and that sounds wonderful, but if you're paying $800 in student loans, you are still going to be in hot water. I work at the University of Rochester, and we have a lot of residents who come in with $600,000, $700,000, $800,000 worth of loans. This is after they have become doctors. They, you know, they live in single room houses. You know what I mean? They really have. It's really not affordable in our country. But I think parents have an obligation to really explore this. And the private schools do offer packages. The smaller ones seem to do better than the larger ones, and that's my comment.
All right, thank you, Abigail. Kevin Connell.
No, I absolutely agree. And, you know, what's interesting is the way that the federal student loan system works is students are capped out at taking out $20,000 in student debt from Stafford loans. And a lot of times what happens is instead of those students then taking out additional private student loans, parents pick up the difference with PLUS loans. That's what my mother did. And those interest, though, the interest rates there are enormous. They're 8-9%. So I absolutely think that parents ought to be really involved because a lot of times they have to forego retiring even because of the student debt that maybe not only that they're trying to pay off, but now they're paying off their kids' student debt. And one of the things that I did want to mention, there's actually a locally based company. It's national. It's CAP Advisory Services. And I met its CEO, Rich Bannister, but it is a college assistance planning sort of financial services system. And what they do is instead of doing kind of individual one-on-one direct-to-consumer financial counseling for thousands of dollars, what they do is they have targeted the employee benefits market. So they sell their program to companies, and then those companies bundle that in with other kind of retirement savings, financial wellness packages to their employees, and the employees get to receive it for free of charge. So I think that that is a great way, you know, for any local company who's talking about, who is thinking about trying to offer employee benefits packages. I would seriously consider CAP Advisory Services because there are thousands of families that are benefiting from it already.
I'm overwhelmed with email. For those of you who couldn't get through, you can meet and talk to Kevin tomorrow morning. He has a book talk on his new book, Breaking Point on the Cost of College. That's tomorrow morning at 11:30 at College Town's Barnes & Noble. I want to read one more email that will help set me up for my last question for Kevin. CJ writes to us and says, the colleges do lock you in the first year is no guarantee for the future. Another huge loss is the exploration and trial and error innovation purpose of college. Now, it's all about what salary you can make when you're done. I was a philosophy major. Could I tell that to my family now? Do that? To be fair, philosophy is excellent preparation for law school, grad school, education, but that's not my base question. Can youth today be open to risks and creativity when they walk in at 18, knowing the pressure of debt that is coming, and if not, what do we lose through this? That's from CJ. I mean, I think the obvious answer is we lose a lot of people who might otherwise want to pursue philosophy or the humanities, but can't quite envision how that helps pay them. And that leads me to my last question through CJ for you, Kevin, which is, what's the prescription? What's within reach? What do we do about this?
So what I do is currently, again, going back to how colleges are ranked, until recently, 0% of a college's ranked was based upon post-graduation performance of students. How well are they performing once they leave? Are they defaulting on their debt? Are they employed? For me, now it's 7.5%. I think that we need to flip that ratio. We need to make it 100%. Colleges need to be evaluated based on how well their students are performing once they leave. So what I would do is they have to report these statistics already to the federal government, and they receive a letter grade. I would attach a credit rating to that letter grade. And based upon that credit rating, they would be capped at the amount of federal aid that students would be eligible for at those institutions. Additionally, I would roll back a 2005 amendment to the Higher Education Act, which took away bankruptcy dischargeability. And the reason for that is Sallie Mae, now Navient, has positioned itself to lend out vast amounts of private loans. So the scary thing here is if colleges don't end up changing so that post-graduation performance is decent so that they are still eligible for aid. What stops them from going to a private student lender and saying, well, we're just going to supplement all the federal aid now with these high interest private loans? Well, by inserting bankruptcy back into the market, you're inserting risk back into the market. Now they're not going to be lending out money to every Tom, Dick, and Harry who shows up. So at that point, then I expect colleges to start cutting programs that are not leading people to good outcomes. And I don't care if it's women's studies or welding. You know, I just think the colleges need to specialize. We have 7,200 colleges in this country offering everything, everything under the sun. It is not a sustainable model. So I just merely think that colleges need to start cutting programs that aren't getting people jobs. We need to be focused on the long-term viability and sustainability of our system.
Kevin Connell is the author of Breaking Point, The College Affordability Crisis and Our Next Financial Bubble. The book's out now. Barnes & Noble at Collegetown tomorrow morning at 11:30. Back in the old digs there. It's nice to see you. Thank you for taking the time for the program.
Thank you very much.
All right, short break. More Connections next.